Welcome to The Crucible, where the Southern African Institute of Mining and Metallurgy gives you a front row seat to conversations with specialists in the minerals and metals sector. SIAM has well over 100 years' experience in and commitment to protecting the professional standards of our industry. Join us now as we discuss the key issues and global initiatives to give you the relevant information needed to make informed decisions, to influence policy that directly affects our sector, and to help our industry grow in an uncertain future.
So welcome to this podcast. We're going to give a brief introduction to the South African Code for the Reporting of Exploration Results, Mineral Resources and Mineral Reserves, which is known as the SAMREC Code. My name is Ken Lomberg. I was the chairman or chairperson of the code until recently, when Nicole Wainsbury, my co-presenter, took over. Let me introduce myself before I ask her to introduce herself. I'm a geologist by profession and currently director of Pivot Mining Consultants, and I do a lot of consultancy work in the mineral resource and mineral reserve space, and I've had the luxury or privilege of doing many trips to different parts of the world to look at different deposits and to help people progress them towards becoming a mine. Nicole, tell us about yourself.
So my name is Nicole Wainsbury, and as Ken said, I've taken over as the SAMREC chairperson. So I have big shoes to fill after Ken's very long tenure in the position, but very excited about going forward and taking over. So myself, also a geologist. I work more in the resource space on the platinum mines. Have been done around locally for 18 years. That's basically my background.
Let's move on to talk a bit about the SAMREC Code. So the SAMREC Code is the code for South Africa. It provides guidelines for the minimum requirements for the public reporting of grade and tonnage of mineral assets. It covers a pretty broad spectrum or broad field, including numerous commodities, including precious metals, base metals, bulk commodities, industrial minerals, and a few others. And not only is it broad in commodity terms, it's also broad in geological settings, from placer deposits to orogenic gold to coal deposits, etc., etc. And then just to add extra complexity, geographic location. So a deposit in a different country or a different continent may well have completely different requirements. So all of these need to be brought into a reporting system. The really important part about it is that the system, or the SAMREC code, allows the reporting of the details of a mineral asset in such a way that other people can understand it who are not technical, and that they can make decisions, particularly about funding of the progression of projects to mines or the ongoing funding of projects. The SAMREC code has been around for, will be 25 years next year, the first edition being published in the year 2000. And it has been developed, or the custodians of the code are the SRMN, the Southern African Institute of Mining and Metallurgy, and the GSSA, the Geological Society of South Africa. So these two organizations have, in the last 25 years, continued to assist to maintain the code. And most of the people who work on the code are actually doing it voluntarily. So let's look a little bit towards why the codes are important, or why the SAMREC code is important. So I'm just going to read out, or just discuss a aspect of why reporting of mineral resources is so important, or mineral resources and mineral reserves. The mining industry is a vital contributor to national and global economies. And that's always been the case, particularly now, because there's a demand for certain commodities, such as now for battery minerals, but it's always been like that. It's a truly international business, so it happens in every country, every continent, and often in quite rural areas. But it requires the trust and confidence of investors and other stakeholders for its financial well-being and for developing these projects. But unlike other industries, mineral deposits are depleting. So as they get mined, they get less and less. So it's not a case of a factory where once a factory is developed, it produces at a similar rate throughout. Once a mine has started, It's eventually going to end and there's going to be nothing left. And that makes it even more important because right at the beginning, the most critical decisions are made. And then the knowledge is not as good as we would like it to be. And we need to communicate those risks and those things associated with it to the investors and to the people who have to make the decisions and put the money in. So it's really important that we develop something that has a level of trust that investors can understand. So that's fundamentally why we have the codes. And it, unfortunately, the reason we have the codes is because of some really terrible situations in the past. So in the 1990s, there was a disaster called BRIEX of a gold deposit in Indonesia called Busang. And the promoters continued to indicate to the industry that they were getting better and better grades and more gold until somebody went and had a look. And when they had a look, they discovered that most of what they were being told was fallacious. And this really brought home the importance of having a way of reporting so that people would understand. And probably the best way to explain it, or a good way to explain it, is to consider it similar to accounting standards or the guidelines used in accounting. Everyone understands what they are. So when somebody looks at the accounts, they can pick out what they need to because they understand it. And so the mineral reporting systems are exactly the same. They're there so that we all understand what's there. And when we look at a declaration of tons and grade, we can start to understand it. As I said, the code, the first SAMREC code was published in 2000. And we've published two versions since then, the latest being 2016. But SAMREC is not alone. SAMREC is one of 15 codes that belong to an umbrella organization called CRISCO. All of these codes are very similar or have exactly the same sort of DNA. And in many cases, they are interchangeable. And the differences are really differences of commodity or slight differences in jurisdiction and the importance of how those codes work. And those are often linked to their local stock exchange. So just like the other codes, SAMREC is linked to the JSE, Johannesburg Stock Exchange, and the Johannesburg Stock Exchange makes it a requirement that all listed companies in the mineral space use the SAMREC code for the declaration of resources and reserves. So that makes it really important for listed companies. However, it's not only important for listed companies, but also for non-listed companies, and that's because people understand what is meant by the tons and grade and the information provided in a mineral resource statement. So those are all important, and those allow people to understand what's there and make necessary decisions about the progression of a mineral resource or a mineral asset. So what I'm going to do is ask Nicole to tell us a little about how the code works so that we can together understand a bit better about how things work.
Great. Thanks, Ken. Right, so I think the first part I'd like to get into, and as Ken mentioned, the code itself sets out a required minimum standard for the public reporting of these exploration results, mineral resources, and mineral reserves. So when companies produce these public reports and they declare the tons and the grade, this is done at different levels of geoscientific confidence, as well as based on different degrees of technical and economic evaluations and studies. So what the code does is it sets out a framework for these estimates to be taken and for the companies then to report on them to the public through the JSE or whatever jurisdiction it is that they're reporting. So when it comes to the different levels of geoscientific confidence, there's different categories, and these are broken down in the code. So when we speak about mineral resources, these are subdivided and reported in order of increasing confidence when it comes to geoscientific evidence. And these categories are the measured categories with the highest confidence, indicated with lesser confidence, and inferred with the least amount of confidence of the evidence or data that you hold. And it is the competent person that will determine these appropriate mineral resource categories. And they do this based on the quantity, distribution, quality of the data that they have available. And it's always important that the competent person states how these confidence levels are determined. It's important that they disclose that. Similarly, when we come to mineral reserves, which is the next step in the declaration of your mineral assets, this is the economically mineable part of your mineral resource, whether it be measured or indicated. And those can then be converted to a proved or a probable reserve based on looking at the modifying factors. When it comes to inferred mineral resources, as I mentioned, those are the ones with the least amount of confidence, and these typically do not form part of the reserves. The reserve categories are further defined by studies, technical studies that are undertaken. And as I mentioned, that includes the application of appropriate modifying factors. So those are the specific categories that mineral resources and mineral reserves are reported in. When we talk about exploration results, those are a little bit different. This is when we sort of have a feel of what's in the ground. We can report not necessarily in categories. Those are sort of within ranges of what we can expect. So there is a little bit less onerous in terms of the reporting of those. So that's the categories of reporting. I mentioned the competent person, and I'd like to just talk about the importance of the competent person in this process, and as defined by the code. So the code defines a competent person as a person who's registered with a recognized professional organization. So for example, that can be SACNAS, the SIMM, Geological Society. There's a whole list. There's about 13 or 14 current recognized professional organizations, and that competent person will belong to those particular bodies. These organizations themselves have enforceable disciplinary processes, including the powers to suspend or expel a member, and this will be based on a complaint that they would receive from an investor or someone in the industry based on what they feel would be an error or incorrect reporting of results. It is required that a competent person has a minimum of 5 years' experience in the style of mineralization and the type of deposit, as well as the activity that they're undertaking. So, for example, if they're estimating resources or supervising the estimation of resources and reserves, they need to have the relevant experience in those particular activities. And it's also crucial that a competent person is satisfied in their own minds, that they're able to face their peers and demonstrate the competence in their commodity or the type of deposit and the situation under consideration. A lot of what a competent person does is self-regulated. Naturally, they have to comply with the code, but a lot of it is self-regulated. And they themselves, as I said, have to be able to stand up to their peers and the industry that what they're doing is right. So documentation detailing the reporting of the exploration mineral resources and mineral reserve in a public report is therefore prepared by or under the direction of a competent person. And these people are listed in the public reports, and CPs are then required to sign off those reports. And therefore, the CP becomes personally accountable and responsible for the parts of the public report that they have signed off. So, as I mentioned, the CPs are essentially legally accountable and liable for what it is that they put out into the public. And the registered professional organizations would then take any action against any person that is reported on, or if there is any error or they believe that there is fraud or something like that in something that a CP has signed off. And so it is quite an onerous task. And
Can I come in there?
Yes, please.
So one of the things that the code is not there is to punish people. So, but importantly, one of the underlying aspects is that the codes use good science and good engineering. So basically the codes are there to make sure that good science, good engineering is applied, so that when the details of an asset are reviewed, that they have some backing that is not just thumbsuck, but has a real basis in good evidence and good way of doing things.
Thanks, absolutely. And I think as well, as you said, it's not there to punish, but it's probably there to keep them honest and keep them on the right track and make sure, as you said, that they are considering what needs to be considered. As you were saying, application of good science and good engineering. that sort of takes me to a discussion on, you know, technical studies and the different types of technical studies that then allow the progression of a mining project. Because typically this project will pass through various phases. You start at the exploration phase, moving on to mineral resource estimation and design phases, into development, production, and then finally closure of a mine. So each of these different studies involve escalating levels of investment. So it's important that these technical studies are accurate and appropriate. And each phase then requires different levels of economic and technical assessment. And as you move through the different phases and the different studies, this increases your level of confidence for the project. And essentially, you have to be able to justify the progression of the project to the next investment level. And the reporting of each of these level of studies needs to be justified as well. So just to take you through some of the different types of studies that are undertaken, typically you would start with a scoping study or a desktop study. It's really an order of magnitude, looking at the potential viability of your mineral resources. And there is some assessment of assumed modifying factors. You don't at this point necessarily have a good understanding, but you have some assumption that you can use based on benchmarking, history, those types of things. So that's sort of a study you would start with, probably at the exploration phase. And when you progress the scoping, you do more drilling, more assessment, get more just scientific information. You then move into a pre-feasibility study. So a pre-feasibility study is a more comprehensive study. It gives you a different range of options for the technical and economic viability of a project. And it advanced to a stage where you've now selected a mining method or a pit configuration, depending on your deposit. And you then determine some effective method of mineral processing as well in a pre-feasibility. It does have a financial analysis based on this. And again, there will be assumptions on your modifying factors a little bit more known because you have now done a bit more technical study. And if the outcome of the study is satisfactory, the competent person can then determine the mineral resource categories and potentially whether they could be converted to a mineral reserve at the time based on the information and the study work that's been concluded. The natural progression then is a pre-feasibility study. We'll move to a feasibility study. Again, higher level of confidence in information and more fact and information gathering. This is now a comprehensive study looking at development options for the project with detailed assessments of applicable modifying factors. You'll have a lot more information now, and you'll then do a detailed financial analysis. And ultimately, what a feasibility study will look at is, can we extract or is the deposit economically mineable? And this level is typically where those investment decisions are made. So the level of the technical and economic study has to be to a level that you can justify that essentially able to progress, get the investment and start up the mine.
Two things that I think are important is that the pre-feas and feasibility studies look at a number of important disciplines. So we look at mining, we look at geology, mining, metallurgy, infrastructure, environmental, social, governance or legal aspects, and then ultimately economic. So all of those are what we call modifying factors, and we look at each of those in order to determine the viability of a mine or of a project. However, our restriction is not only to projects, but also to mines. So we will also do studies, a life of mine study, which will be at the same technical an economic level as a pre-feasibility study or feasibility study to continue to demonstrate that the mine will continue to mine, will be able to mine for the foreseeable future.
And as well in the code, there are specific tables within the code that will then guide the user or the CP on these studies and what could be considered, what should be considered, and reported on when these studies are looked at. So there is a breakdown in the tables in the code. So that's very useful. And it's a good guidance and a framework, as I said, to set out these studies and make sure that you include all the modifying factors as Ken has now detailed. I think I'll pick up on the economic factors that you mentioned, because that's typically, I suppose, make or break on a study. And as we discussed above, in the previous topic about modifying factors, we use the modifying factors to convert mineral resources to mineral reserves. And as Ken mentioned, there's a whole stack of them, but I want to focus on the economic factors. So when it comes to assessment of economic factors, a CP will assess the reasonable prospects for eventual economic extraction, which we call RPEEE, and a reasonable assessment of the modifying factors will then likely influence the prospect of economic extraction and should it be undertaken. The assumptions that are applied when it comes to modifying factors as well as economics need to be at a level appropriate to the level of study, as I mentioned previously, with the different levels of study. So when it comes to economic factors, some of them that are used in these economics assessments include commodity prices, exchange rate, any royalties that will be realized. We look at the cutoff grades and then potential capital and operating costs. And these all form part of the assessment at those different study levels. So as I mentioned, Table 1 and 2 in the code give guidance on the aspects to consider, what economic criteria and analysis should be undertaken to assess projects at these different levels of study. Ken, I don't know if you want to if there's anything in terms of economics that you'd like to elaborate on a bit more.
Well, I think we can also add social there as well. So we also consider the potential social implications, and not all the social implications are negative. In many cases, mines have been responsible for significant economic development. The city of Johannesburg is a classic example. If we hadn't had gold mining, we probably wouldn't have Johannesburg. So that goes for many other cities or towns, that there's a big injection of money, and as a result, the social environment is normally improved dramatically because of mining. So mining has very good a track record, although sometimes not seen like that.
Yeah, that's a very good point, as you say, is that, you know, they don't necessarily always advertise what they do from a social perspective. I was at a conference recently and someone, we were talking about economic and social factors, and they were saying that, isn't it funny how mining always gets a bad rap when it comes to environmental and social, yet the construction industry is huge, and you know it's always great they're constructing, and you know where do people think the materials come from to build those constructions? So I think, you know, as you say, mining sometimes gets a bad rap that's not necessarily fair. And I think if we look at the sort of environmental and social factors, there's been a very strong focus in the industry on the application of environmental and social factors and their inclusion in mineral reporting specifically. There's been a lot of work in some of the other codes that will come in at this stage. But something that you and I discussed is these factors have always been included in the code. They've always been part of the modifying factors. So they've always needed to be considered when assessing projects. They're ingrained within the processes that we do at all levels of the technical study. They always form part of the team, because these studies always have teams of people that are working on and fit together like a puzzle. So environmental and social has always been part of those processes and studies. So, you know, they need to form part of our RPEEE assessments as well. So consideration thereof needs to be demonstrated in the documentation that we produce. So as much as there is a strong focus in the industry, I think we have already included those, and maybe there is some benefit to highlighting them a bit more, or highlighting the fact that we do already consider those factors in our modifying factors. So I think in terms of, you know, how the codes work, those are some of the key topics and the key points that I wanted to raise. I think maybe, Ken, if you can go a bit more into the benefits of the code and how it helps us.
So we've been talking about E and S, but you may well have heard of E, S, and G. So governance is a critical importance to most modern corporates, and the code is the form of governance. Because through the code, and as Nicole was saying, we go through Table 1 and Table 2 almost like a checklist, and we can go through all of these aspects and check the various aspects that form the basis of a mineral resource or mineral reserve estimate, and then that gives us real confidence that what we are reporting has some viability. So the code itself is governance. So the ESG, remember that the codes themselves are governance. But let's move on to look and see what the benefit of the codes are. What we've been talking about sounds like a lot of work, costs money, takes time, and all of that is true. A project doesn't just happen in a very short time. Even if it's a good project, it will probably take between 5 and 10 years to go from an exploration project to being a fully fledged mine. And many investors won't get return on the investment for even longer than that. But that doesn't mean that we should be running away from these things, because the codes provide, as I said, the governance, and it's important that they help to make sure that there's technical expertise applied. Nicole was talking about different levels of study, different forms of geoscientific information. All of those provide technical expertise, things we can rely upon. And what I said much earlier was that there's substantial capital investment right at the beginning of a mine or of an exploration project. And we need to know what the risks are. So the codes help providing a risk matrix. So the level of work that's done helps to mitigate the risks that are there and helps people make the correct investments. Remembering that these are long-term investments, we're not going to get a huge return in a short time, but we will in all likelihood get a good return over a longer period. So the codes then promote best practice. We talked about applying good science and engineering. They allow those to happen and make sure they happen, because the competent person will have to be prepared to face his peers when he or she does an estimate or presents the results. Because the code has these common terms, and the common terms of inferred, indicated, measured, and probable and proved reserves are common throughout all the codes. This is a common language. It's a common concept. Investors understand it, so therefore they can see what the risks are associated with a particular project or mine. They can also be able to do some sort of comparative between different projects when they're doing a transaction, when they're doing a buy-in, when they're doing a merger. All of these things are important. And that really helps them a lot. So the code provides resources and reserves which are used by the industry to value a mine or a project. And by valuing it, then they can work out how best to progress it. So non-technical professionals find it very useful to use the codes or the results of the codes to make investment decisions. But it's not only about that. It's also about giving guidance to the competent person. So the codes themselves are not prescriptive. They are guidance and guidelines. So they give guidance to the competent person. Table 1 and Table 2 are there in particular to give that sort of guidance. As Nicole said, the competent person calls their competence on themselves. That's a type of self-regulation. But we do have a mechanism in place that should there be an issue or some aspect that would be ideal for and needs to be checked, then the competent person can be requested to indicate why or how or what they've done so that they can demonstrate to the peers they've done the right thing. If there's some dispute about that, then there are ways of resolving it, including redoing the work, getting retrained, etc. And ultimately, the competent person would be accountable, which means that it's not just a nebulous corporate that is taking responsibility, but an individual. And individuals normally make a lot more effort to make sure they've done the right sort of thing when they do estimate, when they have a document of a few hundred pages and their name appears on the second or third page as the competent person. I'm sure it makes sure that they think a bit more carefully about what they're reporting. So I think that's the technical aspect. We did mention earlier that the SRMM and the GSSA are the patrons of the code. But I think, Nicole, if you can tell us a bit about how the code is managed and what the future or where the codes are going in the near future.
Absolutely. So the code itself is owned and managed by the South African Mineral Code Standards Committee, what we call the SSC. And the purpose of the SSC, as I said, is to develop, maintain, administer, and ensure compliance with and promote the SAM codes. So under that umbrella, we have the SAMREC code that we've discussed today. There's also the SAMVAL code, which talks to the valuation, the SAMESG code, the SAMOG code, oil and gas, and these all fall under the SAM codes umbrella. And each of those particular codes have a committee that meets on a quarterly basis, and we discuss topics. We look at the maintenance of the codes, if there's things that have come up in industry that people would like to know and discuss. There's a lot of technical discussion in that. So those are quite full meetings. And after the committee meetings, we then have a SSC meeting where everyone's present and we give feedback to the SAM codes committee. The SAM codes, the SSC operates under the joint auspices of the SAIMM and the GSSA, as we mentioned, and there are currently 13 members that sit on the committee, including all of the registered professional organizations, as well as then the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy, as well as a representative from the JSE. There are also three observer organizations that they don't vote in any of the matters that come up for vote. However, they are also part of the committee. As Ken mentioned, the SSC maintains a complaints procedure. So if there are any complaints received about competent persons and competent evaluators, they would then take that up and handle that normally through the registered professional organization. But as Ken said, it's not necessarily a stick. There are other ways to approach it before we get to the stick approach. So it's really just there to assist the CPs in any way as well. So that's the SSC and the structure in terms of the management of the codes. If we look at what's next for SAMREC, so there's been quite a bit of activity, in the code. So when we look at, incorporating ESG, as I mentioned, it is already incorporated, but we established a working group in 2021 and their mandate was to prepare a revised SAMESG guideline, which I'll go into now, and then update applicable sections of the SAM codes themselves to ensure that, you know, we include material ESG considerations and that they're then systematically included in public reports. So the biggest part of that work is the rewrite or the update of the SAM ESG guideline. And what that is, it essentially forms an appendix to the SAMREC code. What's in that guideline is just guidance for the CP, you know, what to consider when it comes to the ESG factors. It's not that those points are mandatory that they have to report on them. It just gives a good guidance as to what can be considered when public reporting. So these documents have been prepared. They have been given to the codes committees for consideration and comment. And that's the point where we are with the changes to the code in terms of ESG incorporation. So essentially going forward, what will happen is that the changes will be either changed or accepted by the SAM codes committees, and that it will go through the SSC and they will come in with the next SAMREC update. However, the SAM ESG guideline will be published before that, so that will be available on our website quite soon. The work is happening on that one. Another guide that we are preparing or currently in the process of is the industrial mineral guideline. Currently there is some guidance on industrial minerals in the code, but very little. So a subcommittee was formed at the beginning of this year, and the purpose and the mandate is to put together a guideline as a supplement to the code, as with the ESG, the SAMESG guideline. This will then guide those that are listed on the JSE from an industrial minerals perspective, how they can report. So thankfully, they are within the CRISCO jurisdiction. There are quite a few documents already floating around in terms of industrial minerals. So we use those as a reference point. And we now have a draft guideline that will then currently go through the committees as well for comment and acceptance. So that's another piece of work that we're basically completed with. Then I spoke about the SAMREC rewrite, or I touched on it. So the last update of the SAMREC code was done in 2016, so it's 8 years now. So there are a few things that have come up and initial discussions that we've held with topics that have been proposed as to, you know, what do we tackle. It won't be a major rewrite. It's really just an update. There is a call for some simplification of the language. There will be some change in the definitions, a little bit more clarification on some things. So those are sort of the biggest points that will be tackled in the ongoing discussions on the rewrite. So look out for that on the website. So those are the things that we've been working at in the committees over the last couple of years. So SAMREC also do quite a bit of training. There's a few courses that we offer. There's a basics and an advanced course. So it just depends on the need for those courses when those are arranged. And those are typically arranged through the SAIMM and the Geological Society. So if you go to those particular websites, you can then see what training is scheduled. That also goes up on the SAMCODES website. And a big milestone for us is the 25th anniversary next year of the SAMCODES. So we will be at the GeoCongress in Bloemfontein in June. So there will be various events that we will be planning for the 25th anniversary. So it's something that we're looking forward to. And a big milestone, as I mentioned, that we will be looking at next year.
Well, I think that we've covered quite a lot of ground. I think we've hopefully giving you some sort of introduction to what the code is all about. Just remember that the code is part of technical, economic, governance, all of those things. But let's go back and just talk, tell you about where you can find information about the code. We have a website, the SAMCODES website, samcodes.co.za. You can look at that. That has got lots of information. We also have an app that you can find there and you can download with the codes on it. So you can have them on your smartphone and you can refer to them whenever you'd like to. If you are interested in being part of or finding out more about the codes, please feel free to contact us via the websites and we will gladly help you in any way that we can. So thank you very much. Thank you, Nicole, for your time. We look forward to hearing from the people listening.
Thanks, Ken, for the great discussion. And as you said, hopefully we've given you a good introduction. But please contact the websites. Do volunteer on the committees if you feel inclined to do so. As we mentioned, it's voluntary, so we need as many ears and eyes as we can. And thanks for the discussion.
Thank you for listening. Please note that the facts and opinions expressed are those of the individual and do not reflect the position of SAIM or the corporate institution.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.